Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Our guest this week is a longtime friend of the show, Tyler Nordgren. Tyler joined us in 2017 to talk about the Great American Eclipse that crossed the United States on August 21st of that year. Nordgren and I watched the eclipse together with about 200 other people on a small ranch in Kimberley, Oregon, near John Day Fossil Beds National Monument, and it was literally the experience of a lifetime. We'll find out about the next opportunity Americans will have to experience one of life's greatest natural wonders, as well as a variety of topics about the dark night sky, including the National Park's preservation of that natural resource and Tyler's retro-style artwork that has become popular in support of the National Park's astronomy programs. Nordgren recently retired from teaching astronomy at Redlands College in Southern California. Tyler, who grew up in Portland, Oregon, joined us from his longtime home in Ithaca, New York, which also happens to be the home of the late Carl Sagan, who taught astronomy at Cornell. Tyler Nordgren, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
It's great to be back here. Thanks for having me on.
Gosh, it's been a while. The last time we spoke with you was right before the eclipse of 2017. So let's go back in time a little bit and talk about that experience and tell me about where you were and what that particular, because I know you've seen many eclipses. Well, before you even talk about it, how many eclipses have you seen now?
I think I've seen something like 8 or 9. I've kind of lost track. I'd have to think about and count on my fingers and toes here at this point.
Wow. Yeah. I've seen one, and it was that one. So tell us about that eclipse for you.
That was the eclipse I had spent my entire life waiting for, because prior to 2017, the Great American Eclipse, the last time a total solar eclipse had touched the mainland United States was back in 1979 up in the Pacific Northwest. And I was a 9-year-old kid up in Portland, Oregon, and I totally missed that because everybody had terrified me into thinking that if you accidentally looked at the sun, you'd burn your eyes out. And so I hid in the house with the curtains drawn and I watched it on TV. So I spent, what was it, 30 years? I spent my entire life really waiting for 2017 to happen, and that did not disappoint. So I was up in Eastern Oregon, prime spot. Beautiful weather.
And I think in a place called Kimberley, Oregon.
Yes, it was just right outside of John Day Fossil Beds National Monument up there. And it was just this beautiful little valley. There were orchards and green grass. And I'd been lucky enough when I was up there about a year or two beforehand scouting out locations. The folks in the town of John Day put me in contact with a lovely woman who had a ranch right there near the midline of totality, just outside of Kimberley. And she was looking to host a group of folks. And we managed to get the Reed College Alumni Association, which is where I'd gone to school. And so it was like me and my closest friends, the professor that taught me astronomy way back in the day. It was the most wonderful experience with the greatest group of people.
Oh, that's, you know, I didn't realize that your former astronomy teacher was there too. That's really cool.
It was the night before the eclipse. Everybody gathered out front of the barn. We had a chuck wagon barbecue, and they had me get up on a box and give a talk about eclipses. And we couldn't find an electrical outlet or a projector. So I just talked. And as the sun went down and the stars came out, I'm standing there under a tree out front of the barn, just talking. And it eventually got to the point where I couldn't see people, they couldn't see me, but it was just voices under the stars. And it was one of those moments that just, as it's happening, you think, this is going to be one of the greatest moments of my life. And I'm, and then the next day dawned clear, and we had just the greatest day you could possibly have.
Yeah, well, I was there with you, so it was wonderful. And I'd have to say, I'm going to share a story with you. We had a really nice campsite, my brother-in-law, Walter, and I, and he had never seen an eclipse before. And then some people came and camped kind of nearby us, and we had deliberately staked out a corner to be away from people. Mm-hmm. And these guys came up, and they were like talking all the time to us. I'm like, okay, would you just go away? Leave me alone. We just want to enjoy the eclipse. And once things kind of got rolling, then all of a sudden these buses came in. A bunch of buses. And I was like, what is with these buses? And the buses came and parked right next to us. And they were your friends from Reed College. And at first I was like, these damn buses, you know, it's like, wow, this is a bummer. But the people were nice. They got off and they went over, you know, with you out in the middle of that field. Well, what was cool was during the eclipse, there's this phenomenon, and I'd like you to explain it to our listeners, called shadow bands. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us what shadow bands are?
Right. So this is a phenomenon that's incredibly brief, and it happens in the last few moments before totality, when you've got just this pinprick of sun that's still revealed, that has not yet gone behind the moon. And so if you imagine this intense pencil beam of sunlight coming down through our atmosphere, and as it encounters all the little ripples and waves in the gases of our atmosphere, all the little hot cells and cold cells in that gas that we're all breathing here, you get waves that ripple, that create constructive and destructive interference in the parlance of optics. And so on the ground, or maybe on like a white side of a building or a sheet, you'll see these waving parallel lines that wave back and forth like little ripples that you might see on a beach. And it's only in those few seconds that these things happen right before totality. And so it's a phenomenon that otherwise you never, ever see, because the sun is always this big disk in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Back to those buses. Sure. Okay. So these buses that I had been kind of cursing, you know, an hour before or whatever, all of a sudden I've got this giant white screen, the side of this bus, perfectly placed. And I look at it, and there are the shadow bands. They look like rippling, almost like shadowy snakes. And it was just so beautiful and mesmerizing. Oh. And I was like, how perfect is this? This bus here is providing me with this giant screen to see this phenomenon that I really wanted to see. Oh. And there it was, thanks to those buses from your school. And I remember yelling out, it's like, shadow bands, shadow bands. And then the people out in the middle of the field with you would just, shut up, we're trying to enjoy the eclipse. I'm like, sorry, sorry, sorry. But I was just mesmerized by that. So the bus that I thought was a bad thing, or just like mm-hmm. an annoyance a little while before, and the people were very nice. But the bus that seemed annoying turned into be the greatest blessing of the day. And it was the most incredible eclipse. All the way home, my brother-in-law, who's never really been interested in astronomy, all he could talk about was how beautiful the corona was through binoculars. And it was such a stunning experience. And thank you for making sure that I got to experience that with you, because I understood after that why people travel around the world to see eclipses.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you felt that way, because so I wrote this book, Sun, Moon, Earth, about eclipses beforehand, and I dragged my wife to must have been 3, 4, 5 dozen various interviews and talks that I gave all around the country. She saw my slideshow. She heard my patter describing what the phenomenon was, and when she came up there and I got her out there, there was a part of me, and I know with her as well, wondering, okay, is this really going to live up to what he's been talking about for the last 2-3 years? And she told me afterwards, she said, yeah, that did. That totally lived up to it. It was it was everything that you said it would be. And that's one of the wonderful things about a total solar eclipse. It blows away any photograph you've ever seen. Any words that you can use to describe it are just completely outstripped by the sun turning black and that corona up there in the sky, and you know, suddenly surrounded by stars. There's a reason why they were omens of doom. It's not a subtle effect.
Yeah. Well, there are some things that, you know, I experienced for the first time that really blew my mind. The first thing was how fast the temperature dropped. Because that was very strange to me. And I've you know, been outdoors when the clouds come over or, you know, weather system comes in, but that's pretty gradual. This was like very sudden. And at first I was like, hey, wait a minute, is it getting cooler? Is that just my imagination? But no, it really did. And it was noticeable. And then the lighting during the eclipse was so strange. It really felt like being on another planet.
Yeah, it is a multi-sensory experience. And there are people that travel the world and see total solar eclipses from airplanes. And in an airplane, you can usually get above the clouds, but not always. And so I can understand why people do that. But you lose that temperature drop. You lose the hair on your arms suddenly standing up in those last few seconds. You lose the sound of birds suddenly going quiet or the crickets coming out. There's all this stuff beyond what you just see with your eyes. So for that reason, I've never done an airplane.
Yeah. And you, like what you said, it's such a sensory experience that it's almost overwhelming. And you can see why some people cry. I've seen that, you know, many times in videos of people watching that eclipse where they're just, you know, crying and they don't really know why. And it's just your sensory system is just overloaded by all this stuff.
Yeah. After the eclipse, in the half hour, couple hours afterwards, I went around and I started doing interviews with people who'd been there because I thought, oh, hey, maybe I'll do a 2024 update of my book for the next total solar eclipse we're going to get in the U.S. And it struck me that every single person I talked to was just beaming and smiling and talking about how connected they all felt. And everyone, people were saying, you know, and I'm not usually one of those sort of woohoo sort of people, but you just felt that you were part of something larger, connecting with things. And there's a psychologist, Dr. Kate Russo, who actually studies that eclipse phenomenon on the people who've been there and seen it and communities that prepare for it. So, it really is something special.
Yeah, it exceeded my expectations, which were really high. You know, they were super high, but it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever experienced. And you know, it was what was hard afterwards. Just between you and me, listeners out there, don't listen to this part. When I got back to Northern California, people were sharing with me, oh yeah, we saw the eclipse down here too. It was really cool. And they saw the little weird patterns from the leaves on the ground and everything, and maybe looked through those eclipse glasses and saw it. And I'm just like, no, you don't understand. You did not. You know, what you saw was, yeah, a partial eclipse. But the only comparison I could give is it's like the first time you make love to your love of your life compared to a hug and a kiss from grandma.
it was one of those things that when talking to communities, I was part of the American Astronomical Society Planning Task Force. And we talked to so many communities about, look, you're just outside the path of totality, like Portland, Oregon. You guys are just right outside. Seriously, you need to get down there into the path. 99% totality is not 99% of the wonder. And so many people just didn't buy that. Portland schools shut the kids up inside their schoolrooms so that, you know, they too wouldn't burn their eyes out in a strange replay of my experience in 79. But as I drove into totality the day before, we stopped off at like a pharmacy in Condon, Oregon, where the pharmacists they were literally a 10-minute drive from totality. And they said, yeah, no, we got to keep the pharmacy open. We'll pop out at lunch and we'll look up. And
wow. You know,
it's 99.95 here, so I'm sure that'll be good. And I tried, but
yeah, that's like, it's 99.5 is nothing compared to 100%.
If you're just joining us, our guest is retired astronomy educator and artist Tyler Nordgren. Tyler is one of the nation's foremost experts on eclipses and the author of the books Sun, Moon, Earth about eclipses and Stars Above, Earth Below, a guide to astronomy in the national parks. I'm Dave Schlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with astronomer, eclipse chaser, and artist, Tyler Nordgren.
Everybody I know that I care about, I tell them, I hope, one of my greatest hopes for you, is that once in your life, you will experience a total eclipse of the sun, because I guarantee it won't disappoint. I did not talk to a single person that was in the path of totality that did not feel that way.
Yeah. Well, the next opportunity, we tell people, you know, there's a once in a lifetime opportunity, but the next one is going to happen in the U.S. on April 8th, 2024.
Yeah.
And it's April. It's at a time of year that's not going to have as good a weather as we had in August of 2017, but it goes over some big cities. And it's going to, in totality, it's going to last for twice as long. It's going to be like 4 minutes.
What are the cities? Give us a sense of that path.
Let's see. San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Buffalo, Niagara Falls, Rochester, parts of Montreal. I mean, those are going to be like the major cities in that path. Texas has got and then down in Mexico, Mazatlan, right down there on the coast. So Mexico and Texas have the best opportunity for clear weather on that day in April. Once you get up to Buffalo, Niagara Falls, you know, it's, you know, who knows?
You can get roll of the dice.
No, yeah, you never know. But imagine standing on the American side of Niagara Falls and seeing totality directly above the falls from that vantage point.
Goodness.
Wow. So yeah, there's all sorts of amazing opportunities, but what we imagine in our planning for 2024 is that everybody who didn't go to see it in 2017 and had their neighbors come back and tell them, man, you missed the experience of a lifetime. Yeah. We suspect this is your shot. If you missed it before, go. If you didn't miss it, if you saw it in 2017, you know, go. It's do it. Take that day off. And it's another Monday, as it turns out, just like it was in 2017. So make a long weekend of it.
Well, I'll be retired then. And so I have plans. I'm going to Texas to hopefully watch it with some of my friends from the Apollo program.
Oh,
Yeah, so that's going to be special. I hope, you know, hope that all works out. And then, of course, right now, before we move on, mm-hmm. I do want to mention that one of the things I really learned from you and from a lot of people and my own experiences, if you are planning on seeing that eclipse, you better start making your plans now, Because if you wait until 6 months ahead or whatever, you'll find that almost every hotel, motel, campground, blah, 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 is already booked.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are serious eclipse chasers who've booked 3 hotels along the path of totality and are waiting until like 3 days before it happens to see where the weather is going and drive in the opposite direction of the clouds. But but with those cities, there will be places to go. And, you know, we were in our little field with 300 people, but imagine what it would be like to be standing in downtown Dallas and have suddenly 100,000 people screaming in unison when totality happens. It just sends shivers down my spine thinking about it.
Ooh, that just, it made me think about what an interesting place Dealey Plaza would be to watch the eclipse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that kind of interesting juxtaposition of history and cosmic events. Okay, so let's talk about the other thing going on right now, which is the pandemic. And let's hope by 2024, you know, we're past this and we can travel again. I'd like to know for you, as somebody who does a lot of traveling and exploring, and do talks and you go to the national parks, what has the pandemic been like for you, you know, in this time of shutdown, being a professional skygazer?
I've got very mixed feelings about it, and I'll tell you why it's mixed here in a second. But the last trip I left was to Alaska for the Northern Lights back in the end of September, end of February, beginning of March. And so as I flew home from Alaska, having seen these Northern Lights, which are also a spectacular event to see with the naked eye, we passed through Seattle and other airports just as those first reports of people coming down with COVID came out. And by the time I got home, 2-3 days later, everything was shut down. And for the company, Bedchart Expeditions, that works with the Planetary Society, that was the last trip they wound up running. I'm supposed to be doing a total solar eclipse trip to Argentina this December, and we have no idea what's going to happen. So in that regards, it's so depressing because there are so many life-changing bucket list things that people want to see. And traveling to, I took a group to Chile last summer to see the total solar eclipse down there. And we spent it with a little village up in the foothills of the Andes where we were the only Americans. And the entire village came out, and the schoolmaster hosted us at the school, and we bought supplies for the kids. And it brought tears to my eyes. What an amazing experience we were able to share with everyone there. And I know that they were all hoping that that would be the start of tourists finding out about their wonderful valley and the dark skies, and people would start coming. And, well, of course, no one's coming because of the pandemic. So it's heartbreaking. So this last June, June 21st, the summer solstice, I was at home and really depressed because I was supposed to have been leading an annular eclipse trip to Tibet. And we were going to be standing on the shores of this lake in Tibet at 14,000 feet with the annular eclipse sun high overhead. And, you know, that's a bucket list trip for me, too. And so as I'm sitting at home, very depressed about this, going to, you know, figure, well, I'll just stay up till 1 a.m. and I'll watch this on this live web stream. 2 hours before it started, I had a heart attack.
Oh, my.
And, you know, fortunately, I live a block and a half from the ambulance company. And so I was in the hospital. And at the time the eclipse was happening, I'm there on the operating table, still awake, thinking, oh, yeah, the eclipse is happening right now. I think I'm only alive because of the pandemic. So yeah, if it hadn't been for the pandemic, I might be dead now, or at least have, you know, major heart damage.
That's amazing, Tyler. Yeah, that, you know, to think about how that, you know, put you in the right place at the right time and literally saved your life. That's amazing.
So I'm taking things as they come. I'm hoping that this pandemic that is has been so devastating for so many people emotionally, psychologically, financially. We'll all come out of this. And so at the moment, I'm exploring my little section here of upstate New York. And when the comet Neowise came along, I couldn't go out to the desert Southwest. I couldn't get out to these super dark sky locations. But I found a vineyard. I sat in a vineyard and I got to see the comet. So you take life the way it comes to you and the joys that it brings.
Yeah, and it was a good one. We had a little debate on whether it's a great comet or not. And you, as we discussed this, you raised an interesting question that I hadn't thought about, and I'd like to kind of talk about that next. Is you mentioned, you know, the desert Southwest, and you do a lot of work with the national parks, and one of the precious resources, like for my park, Lassen Volcanic National Park, where I do volunteer work, is the dark night sky. And you raised the interesting point that when those last big comets that we had, Hyakutake in 96 and Hale-Bopp in 97, the sky wasn't as light polluted then as it is now.
Yeah. So one of the defining characteristics of a great comet is how big its tail is, but how bright it is, how easily you can see it. And Hale-Bopp and Hyakutake were these comets that you could stand in the middle of a brightly lit campus or city center and see those comets overhead. With Neowise, you had to know where to look. But once you knew, there it was. Well, I mean, the last 20 years, as we all know, have gotten brighter and brighter. And now that I've come back, for instance, to my little small central New York town of Ithaca, I can see what 20 years has done. I can see that it is brighter here, that places I knew that used to be out way out in the countryside with very little artificial light. No, there's more lights around, and those lights have gotten brighter. The LED, the blue-white LED revolution of around 2010 has really been a detriment to the darkness, the purity of the night sky. And so part of me kind of wonders if Hale-Bopp and Hyakutake were to be coming around now, would we really see them as easily as we had back then? And places like Grand Canyon and other national parks, natural bridges, I know for a fact that they've gotten a little bit brighter now than they were just 10, 20 years ago. So how easily are we going to be able to see these great comets in the years that we have ahead of us? Don't know.
Yeah. Well, and my, I don't know, my definition of a great comet is it just blows you away how beautiful it is. For me, Neowise was a really good comet and a lot of fun and came at the perfect time. You know, it was like I needed something like that. So I think it's just up to the individual. If it was great for you, then it's a great comet.
Yeah. And this was probably the most photographed comet because the thing that's happened since we had Hale-Bopp back in 97 is we've had the digital camera revolution. And there are so many more people with cameras. I was even able to get a photograph with my iPhone 11. It was a crummy photograph, but it was a photograph. And so, I mean, there are people out there that are now doing just some amazing night sky photography. And that's one of the best things that's happened, especially in national parks, is you can go online and in places that aren't even dedicated to astronomy, websites, they're just Park Service fan pages. So many of those photographs are showing the Milky Way above Delicate Arch or of Yosemite and El Capitan. So it's something a lot more people are aware now of just how beautiful the night sky is when you get to someplace like a national park. And when I wrote my first book back in 2010, Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. One of the things that I told people was half the park is after dark. So many people back then used to ignore that other half of the park when the sun was down. But people today, they get it. They see stars there that they can't see at home anymore.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the best things about going camping in the mountains or, you know, wherever you go camping when people live in the city, is that nighttime experience of going outside and, you know, really seeing the stars. I remember my first experience with that was when I was 7 or 6, something like that. And it was the first trip to visit my family in Paradise, California. And I had grown up in Los Angeles. And there, you know, you can see the brightest stars in Orion and the bright planets like Venus and Jupiter, kind of the Big Dipper, but not much. And then I remember getting out of the car, and back then Paradise was a much smaller town than before it was destroyed in 2018.
Yeah.
It just blew my mind to look up and see the Milky Way and all those stars. It almost gave me like vertigo.
I was really lucky. My first postdoc after getting my PhD at Cornell was at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. And Flagstaff has the nation's longest history of light ordinances because of the presence of both Lowell Observatory, founded by Percival Lowell, and the U.S. Naval Observatory. And so back in the 50s, when car dealerships were first using big searchlights to advertise their cars, the folks there in Flagstaff said, hey, we need to preserve the night sky for these telescopes. And so when I was there in, 1999, you could stand in the middle of town, look up on Route 66 and see the Milky Way overhead. And that was spectacular. It was my, meteor showers and zodiacal light, all these things that I'd read about and heard about, but never seen with my own naked eye. And then I went from there to my first faculty job in Southern California. And I just wanted to cry because all those stars disappeared into the glow of Los Angeles. And it was a point where you could look up and you could see, I remember counting once, I counted 12 stars in the sky. And I think one of those stars was on approach to LAX. So
yeah, I know what those stars look like.
Yeah.
And it is sad. And sad to think so many people that live in urban areas never experience that.
Right. And one of the things that I encountered with my students was that when you grow up in a place like that, a city or even a town at this point, suburbs, where you can see maybe only a handful of stars, not even really a full constellation, that even when something does happen up there in the sky, like Jupiter and Venus, or maybe a meteor shower or something, when things like that happen, you've trained yourself to not even look up to see them. Because normally there's no point in looking up because there's nothing really interesting going on up there. And so we've trained a whole generation or two at this point to not even bother looking up. And when you don't look up, you don't develop that wonder at the universe outside our own atmosphere.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of Arian Copeland, a friend of mine who is also a surfer, and he's black. He's a black surfer. And we were discussing a lot of topics about pollution and climate change and racial injustice. And we can throw in light pollution into that bucket. And he said, you know, it's all the same thing. All of these things they're all the same. They're all together in this one thing. And so, you know, they're all forms of depriving us of the beauty of nature and living a better life. So, you know, any chance you can get to support toning down the artificial lighting, you know, I'm all for that. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Our guest is Tyler Nordgren. Tyler is a retired astronomy educator and artist, an advocate of astronomy in the national parks, and an eclipse expert. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back. Let's return now to my conversation with astronomer and artist Tyler Nordgren. You know, one of the things that just has always impressed about me about you is that you're an artist. When did you first develop that interest and love of art? How did that come about?
It was when I was a kid. Back there when I was 9 years old, back in Portland, Oregon, I drew. I just drew cartoon characters that I saw in books. I remember in the lead up to that eclipse, one of the things we did in school was we drew what the eclipse was going to look like. And I remember drawing my first corona around the eclipse sun. And so it was, the artwork was something that had always been really important to me. And through high school and college and even graduate school, I was a political cartoonist. I drew a weekly comic strip in the newspaper. I even got a job at the Ithaca Journal here out of graduate school. So I was a professional cartoonist at one point. But all through that time, I kept wondering, because I had this love of astronomy, what did I want to do with my life? And I remember consciously making the decision that it would probably be easier to be a professional astronomer that did art on the side than to be a professional artist that did astronomy on the side. So I got the PhD at Cornell in astronomy and went on, became a professional astronomer. But I've been really fortunate to be able to bring that that artwork back into it.
And I've always been curious about this because there are many instances of great scientists who also love to record in journals through drawing and recording their experiences, especially, you know, we think about the great naturalists like Darwin and people like that. What do you think it is about art that also connects to a scientific way of thinking about the world?
Well, I know one of the things for me is that with art, one of the things that that comes to my mind is when you look at some of these amazing Hubble pictures of nebulae, the Orion Nebula, for instance. You know, you're talking about the play of light and shadows, illumination, stars inside this giant cloud of gas and dust. Where does that light fall? How is it casting shadows? And so, I mean, there's so much about understanding that play of light and matter. I mean, in fact, Galileo, he actually taught students in Florence during the Renaissance about how light interacts with solid three-dimensional objects. And it was because of that knowledge in the Renaissance that when he did look at the moon, he was able to make sense of the light and shadows he saw there to figure out, oh, I'm looking at a hole, or I'm looking at a mountain. He knew what he was seeing. Thanks to artists, you know, Galileo discovered the moon was a place.
Yeah. And you mentioned to me the other day that one of the Apollo astronauts is a personal hero for you. Could you tell us about that?
So I was born November 18th of 1969. The Apollo 12 astronauts were on approach to the moon, about to descend down to the moon. In fact, they might even have been in the LEM on their way down to the lunar surface when my dad tells me he was in the hospital watching them land there in the hospital. One of the astronauts on Apollo 12 was Al Bean, who was an artist. And he took elements of his experience as an astronaut walking on the surface of the moon and incorporated it into his art. So if you were ever to have one of his original pieces, there are impressions in the plaster on the painting made from the his boot. He took little bits of lunar dust from his spacesuit and sprinkled that into the paint and the pigment. So I mean, I've always been a fan of his, and I had wanted to be an astronaut when I was growing up. And I think it was sometime in college when my eyesight began to go bad and I needed glasses that astronaut became astronomer. But the fact that he was this astronaut artist who walked on the moon when I was born has always made me be a huge fan of his. And so I've followed his artistic career and I've got a book of his artwork. Always been a huge fan of his.
Yeah, he was a very lovely man, just a beautiful human being. And here's a good story for you about Al Bean. Is one of his really good friends at NASA, one of his supervisors, when he decided to retire, and he said, "Well, what are you going to do?" You know, a lot of those guys would go to work for as consultants for aerospace industries and into finance or airlines, and they'd, you know, make a lot of money. And have, because the astronauts really, you know, for all the glamour and glitz of the Apollo program, they didn't make a lot of money being an astronaut. So a lot of them, you know, afterwards would find these good jobs and make some good money. And Al said, you know, "I'm going to be an artist." And this guy said, "Oh man, you don't want to do that." And really tried to discourage him, you know, just out of friendship, not to be mean. But, you know, Al was just like, you know, didn't listen, you know, just like, "Yeah, I know you're trying to give me good advice, but I'm not following it." And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. And we're blessed by his incredible artwork.
Yeah, I was really lucky. When I worked on that first book about astronomy in the national parks, I needed illustrations for it. And I was a poor university professor, didn't make a lot of money. I'd sunk my entire savings into traveling through the national parks for a full year, working on all the ways that people would experience astronomy in the parks. And so I thought, well, okay, I used to draw. I can do an illustration for this book. And I did it in the style of those old WPA posters. And instead of "See America," it was "See the Milky Way," and in America's national parks. And that resonated with park rangers and readers. It became one of the most popular things out of that book, to the point that park rangers asked if they could use it, and if maybe I could do another poster that had a Black Canyon of the Gunnison or a Joshua tree in it. And, you know, here we are 10 years later, I've got like 54 of these posters for parks all over the country. They're on sale in park gift shops. People recognize them. It led me into doing artwork for the national parks for the 2017 eclipse. And it allowed me to actually retire from my professor job. And so, you know, kind of like Al having the second career after astronaut becoming an artist, who would have ever thought it? After becoming an astronomer, well, I'm now an artist. And so I'm so thankful at how these things work out.
Yeah, it's like it came full circle for you. I love that style of art, that it is so retro, back to the 30s and those wonderful WPA posters that you mentioned, and the way you do them, and the Milky Way, like over a place like Bumpus Hell that I know in Lassen Volcanic National Park or wherever, those posters are just wonderful treasures to have for, you know, your favorite national park. How did you first get connected with the parks? When did you decide, or how did that happen, where you became, you know, the parks was going to be this avenue for you?
It was one of these wonderful coincidences. I had just gotten tenure at my university, and so I splurged and bought myself my first digital camera and thought, I'm going to treat myself to a little vacation to explore this camera. And so I went up to Yosemite National Park, and it was I think late May, and so the campgrounds weren't completely full. It was gorgeous weather. The waterfalls were rushing, and the Milky Way would rise about midnight there. And it was stunning, as it later in the night, it would just arch over from rim to rim within the valley. And one night I happened to see a poster for a ranger astronomy talk over at the lodge. And I thought, well, gosh, I love astronomy. Let me go see this fellow. And It was Ranger Kevin Poe, who is normally at Bryce Canyon, who's out there at Yosemite, and he gave this talk about the astronomy on display in national parks because it's so dark there. And as I'm sitting in this outdoor amphitheater and the stars come out overhead, I hear the audience around me oohing and aahing over these pictures that Kevin is showing. And then eventually he shows a picture of the Milky Way. And I realize, wow, you know, I've seen the Milky Way when I've been up at Palomar or these other observatories. For most folks, they've never seen it. And then lo and behold, you know, later that night, the Milky Way is overhead. And I think, you know, people are probably seeing it for the first time tonight. And that's when it dawned on me. I've got to go up and introduce myself to this fellow and find out how can I get involved? Because one of the things he mentioned was a group called the Night Sky Team, the National Park Service Night Sky Team, whose mission it was to go out and measure light pollution in the national parks and to find the darkest places and do what they could to preserve these dark, starry skies. And I wanted to be a part of that. And I can literally say that was the night that changed my life. Because about 2 years later, when I had a sabbatical coming up, I spent that sabbatical at the national parks. It was 14 months in 14 different national parks working with rangers all over the country on astronomy and astronomy outreach to visitors, but also night sky preservation for the resource managers, and just convincing the parks that half the park really is after dark. It is something that everyone should care for. And it changed my life. I've heard from some rangers, it's changed the course of preservation at some of their parks, and that there are astronomy programs in some parks that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't come around at that time. And so it's just a real tremendous honor to be working with park rangers to this day. In fact, I was, unfortunately, one of the first things that got canceled due to the pandemic is I was supposed to be training park rangers to give night sky programs. We had a whole night sky academy out at Death Valley that got canceled at the end of March. But someday it'll happen.
Yeah, you bet. And I know that I'm very fond of the Lassen Dark Sky Festival here, and you've been there, and Ranger Kevin Sweeney runs that or did. And it's a fabulous program, and it's just a way to connect people with a part of the park they don't even realize that is there to experience. And they just, you know, you think about, well, at night I'm going to be by the campfire getting in the tent, you know, but there's just walk out away from the campsite and look up, and what a magical experience that is.
Exactly. And it takes effort to communicate that to people, because, you know, now you go someplace like Yosemite or Grand Canyon, and the lodges have TVs in them. So you don't even have to go outside anymore. You can just assume, you know, the sun goes down, you go home and watch Netflix or something. But with those WPA posters, one of the things that I really tried to do was make that connection with what the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, was all about in the 1930s, which was using art to communicate and educate people about, you know, maybe, you know, brushing your teeth or watching out for syphilis, or, you know, go and visit the national parks. Well, today I'm using that medium to inform people that go and see the Milky Way. The national parks are more than just what you see by day.
Yeah. And boy, if there's one thing that I could wave a magic wand, it would be to see our national parks restored to the glory that they used to have as far as the funding for the ranger programs, because they really are being underfunded, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. I've talked to so many rangers where I'll hear them joke that they're paid in sunsets and rainbows. And I know so many of them that they work a park during the summertime, and as soon as the summer tourist season is up, their job ends and they pack all their belongings in a VW microbus and they head south looking for warmer climates and warmer parks to get another job at. Those rangers are doing it because they love it. And I wish they got paid more than just in rainbows and sunsets.
Yeah, and that there were more rangers. You know, the ranger programs that I remember as a kid that you could go see, those are farther, fewer and farther between than they used to be. Before we let you go, you mentioned to me about another eclipse you're going to go see at a really exceptional place very far south. Tell us about that.
So my hope, my plan, my dream is that this whole pandemic will have gone away or be under control by the time December of 2021 rolls around, because at that point there is going to be a total solar eclipse visible from Antarctica. And at the moment, I've been chosen to lead an eclipse expedition that's going to be on an ice-breaking ship that's going to be a three-week cruise from the southern point in Argentina out to the Falklands and the South Georgia Island, and see totality, experience totality from the ice flows right off of the Antarctica ice shelf. And the totality will be visible very low. I think it's like 11 degrees or something off the horizon. And so just imagine journeying to, you know, the ends of the earth and seeing this eclipse happening over icebergs and the ice sheet down off the coast of Antarctica. So who knows? But my fingers are crossed.
Let's hope for the best, because that just sounds spectacular. Well, we're out of time, but as always, thank you for joining us and sharing your love of the night sky and your art and your passion for educating all of us about, you know, the joy of going outside. You don't need a telescope, just your warm, moist eyeballs, and go experience the universe in your backyard or a national park. Thank you so much, Tyler.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me back.
Thanks once again to our guest, Tyler Nordgren. You can check out his astronomy and national parks retro-themed artwork at tylernordgren.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.